not your normal theme music for open air today. We have a live performance in concert, the Friction Quartet, which is Doug Matches, Kevin Rogers, Otis Harriell, and Taya Warbelow. We'll be hearing from them a little bit later. They'll be talking about their performances this weekend. For Irregular Resolutions, a concert called Pulling Strings at the Center for New Music. Also this hour on Open Air, we'll be visiting with the folks involved in Uncharted, the Berklee Festival of Ideas. Lance Noble and Mina Girgis will be talking about that festival that happens tomorrow and Saturday. The Nile Project will also be discussed. Peter Robinson offers a meditative essay for the coming month of November and a review of the film Fury. And Rebecca Fisher is in studio to talk about Memphis on My Mind at the Marsh. Stay with us here on KLW. Memphis on My Mind at the Marsh in Berklee is written and performed by Rebecca Fisher, developed with and directed by Charlie Varon, no stranger to these airwaves. This 2013 San Francisco Best of Fringe solo show offers several perspectives of the hometown Rebecca Fisher shares with Elvis, Beale Street, barbecue, the mighty Mississippi, and those steamy hot summer days. Rebecca Fisher is a director, producer, and award-winning writer and performer of solo work. Her Bay Area work in the arts began at the Julia Morgan Center for the Arts in the year 2000, where she was actively involved in the education programs and co-created and continues to co-produce a monthly solo performance series, Tell It on Tuesday. Also, no stranger to the Marsh, Rebecca's first solo show, The Magnificent of the Disaster, had a successful run at that venue before going on a full tour. Rebecca, welcome to KLW.
Well, thank you for having me.
Happy to be here. Happy that you could spend some time. So this is kind of a chronicle of life in Memphis.
It's a lot of different things. It started off being, Memphis on My Mind, started off being about this crazy mayoral race that was happening in Memphis. That was like 5 or 6 years ago. And then as I kept working on the piece, it became clear that it needed to be about something else. My director, Charlie Varon, who at the Marsh, he would say, "You're a plant searching for light." And as I kept working on the piece, I knew it needed to, I knew it wanted to be about Memphis because that's just this place that I love, and it's like in my bones, I feel like. And it became about this woman that used to work for my mother's family. Her name was Sarah Mackey. And it, so it's about her, it's about the city, it's about my relationship to this place, and it's all of those things.
Let's talk about that maid.
Okay.
That was a strong influence.
Yeah, I know. So that's right. I was going to say that maids were, there used to be when maids were the folks that used to, that's what, you know, we don't say that anymore, but cooked and cleaned and took care of the kids. It's very old, you know, old Southern kind of paradigm. And she started working at my grandfather's company, the White Rose Laundry, and which was clean restaurant linens and uniforms. And through a series, she had this accident and she ended up working in the home, and she was very integrated into my family. And then I lost touch with her for like many years, but then we got reconnected through the loss of her son and of my mother. And we had this kind of profound connection. You have to see the show to find out what that's about. But
give us a little hint there.
A little hint there, right. And so, and then about her grandson. But it's really also about just that these people, she represents this emblematic of just what Memphis is to me and what my connection to this place. And cities have such character, and it's because of the people that, you know, live there and that pull on us, mm-hmm. Heartstrings.
Well, speaking of characters, there's a hustler involved in the show, too, that you're portraying.
That's correct. It's her grandson who we have this, we have a relationship, and through it we meet, and, well, I don't want to tell the whole story, but yes, that is correct. I play lots of different characters in Memphis on My Mind, and I talk a lot about just the city and how it's like, you know, every city has like a character. Like you think of Berklee and Oakland and Alameda. If you describe them as people, how would you describe them? And so I go through like the cities of Tennessee, like, you know, Knoxville. You don't hear much about Knoxville, do you? No, because it's like the strange brother that lives alone in the mountains. And then, like, you know, you go to Nashville. It's stable and secure. You know, she's got country music, but she's like the state debutante. You know, a little bit clueless.
But like Chattanooga has the shame of kicking out the Indians. And Memphis, it's got slave trade on the Mississippi where Martin Luther King was assassinated. It's consistently ranked as a crime capital of our nation. But that girl has got it going on. She is cooler and edgier. And so, but she never quite makes it.
Well, it's a ripe town for material, that's for sure.
It is. I actually just learned, I was looking before I came online, that Memphis, Tennessee is actually the song that's mentioned the most in, city that's mentioned the most in songs. So I'm not the only one with Memphis on my mind, clearly.
Interesting. Well, Elvis had it on his mind quite a bit, too.
Elvis, and then there's, well, there's a lot of different, yeah. Elvis, B.B. King, Memphis Jug Band. There's that Mark Cohen song, Walking in Memphis.
Sure.
There's Memphis on my, there are actually, what's the, a Memphis in the Meantime. There's a another song, Dylan, oh, God. I should have them all listed, but in my pursuit to, you know, think about this place and, you know, that it's actually a lot of, it holds soul for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about your work with Charlie Varon, who's been on here before. He's such an innovator, such a way he cultivates talent so well.
Oh, you know, Charlie has been fantastic. I've worked with him now on this piece for the last 5 years, and just his holding of the story and his encouragement to, like, just, I'm always changing it around. And this time for the show, what I'm doing is, it's called Memphis on My Mind with Barbecue and Blues in Berkeley, is that I'm making it, like, you see the show in the main stage at the Berkeley Marsh, and then you leave and you get your meals and that are catered by Gregoire, which does these fantastic picnic dinners, and they're going to make a specially made barbecue, catfish, fried chicken, and a vegan gluten-free option.
Nice. All right.
You know, got to take care of everyone. And then you go into the cabaret.
In Memphis, I think the actual vegans would be served.
Exactly. I think they probably now have vegan barbecue sandwiches.
Yeah,
right,
probably
there.
So.
So you go in the bar and cabaret, and you get this you get listen to the blues. I've got musicians lined up for each night because Memphis is known for the blues. So it's a
Beale
great
Street Caravan, man.
Huh?
Beale Street Caravan.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. And so Charlie was very enthusiastic about this idea about, like, and what I love about the Marsh and Stephanie Wiseman and Charlie and David Ford and is that they're like, oh, yes, let's try that. Okay, that hadn't been done. But actually, it was done recently by a show called Mark Kenward's Nantucket, where he had this idea, like, we're going to have a show and then a meal in between. And we're like, okay. And it worked really wonderfully, like the way that people were connecting it during intermission. And so I was like, I'm going to build upon that experiment. And that's what I love about working with Charlie and just the Marsh in general is that, you know, let's think outside the box and what, because these days it's hard to get people out to theater. That's the thing is, well, how can we make it where you connect with your community and you, you know, talk with each other and it's theater and food and music, you know, so you walk home with Memphis in your body and your soul.
Nice. And a full stomach as well.
Exactly. Exactly. So, Charlie has been fantastic. I feel like he's held the story. And again, I didn't know it was going to be about this woman, Sarah. He was like, I think the story's going to be about Sarah. And I was like, I guess you're right. And then I remembered that I had made this whole movie. I'd filmed her talking about when her son died. I never made the movie. I wanted to make the movie, you know? And I was like, I'd always wanted to tell this, but I kind of didn't know that that was a story that I wanted to tell, like all these processes. You know, you start and then you keep showing up. And with Charlie's guidance, I've sort of found what it is supposed to be.
Mm. I'm wondering, as a performer myself, I can't imagine doing a whole solo show like that and remembering what comes after each segment. Do you have some sort of mnemonic device? Or how do you make sure you go to the right next scene?
Well... That's very important, especially if you have a technician that's following you, you know,
oh,
if your
gosh,
light cues.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the big thing that, you know, Charlie and Mark, who I've just mentioned, Mark Kenward, they always talk about doing repetitions. And it really is kind of like that, just like getting in your body like
muscle
you do.
Muscle memory, sure.
Muscle memory.
Sure.
So
sure.
That, and then as everyone tells you, and I think it's true, like, you know, shows always vary, but, you know, you hope that the experience for the audience, like, they don't know all the things that might be a little different or, you know, things how you change it or don't do it as great one night. But That's a very good question. I think it's muscle memory and, like all good things, practice, as I tell my kids. You get better when you keep doing it.
That's Rebecca Fisher, Memphis on My Mind, written and performed by Rebecca, developed with and directed by Charlie Varon, runs through November 23rd at The Marsh in Berkeley. Information at themarsh.org. Rebecca, we wish you a fantastic run.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're quite welcome.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie.
To get on your mind for Memphis for Rebecca Fisher's show at The Marsh. Good afternoon, David Lotz-Gilib with you for Open Air. Still to come, some live music from the Friction Quartet. We'll be talking about the Uncharted Berkeley Festival of Ideas next. And also, Peter Robinson will be in before hours out. We'll also have some tickets to give away before the end of Open Air. Some tickets to the Peninsula Symphony, as well as to a live performance in theater of the Bolshoi Ballet. So stay with us. Next is to talk about a little bit the Uncharted Berkeley Festival idea of ideas. It's a two-day festival of ideas and activities for InfoWars taking place tomorrow and Saturday in Berkeley. Conversations with leading thinkers, hands-on experiences, wonderful food and drink in downtown Berkeley. Uncharted Berkeley Festival Idea was founded just last year as the Bay Area's first ideas festival and will bring together some of the world's great thinkers for two thrilling days of discussion, debate, and workshops designed to engage and inspire. Here to talk about the festival is Lance Noble, founder and curator of Uncharted. Lance has had a varied, eclectic international career at the intersection of business, geopolitics, and technology. He started Berkeley's independent news site, Berkeleyside, in 2009 and continues to work as co-founder and co-editor. He's worked with the World Economic Forum and was part of Prime Minister Tony Blair's strategy unit in London, which examined medium and long-range strategic issues. He was an assistant editor of the Architectural Review and has published four books on architecture and design. Lance, welcome to KALW.
Thanks, David.
He's joined by Mina Girgis, Uncharted speaker and founder of the Nile Project, which we're very excited to talk about. Mina is an ethnomusicologist and entrepreneur who specializes in curating and producing innovative musical collaborations across diverse styles. He also explores new ways to design environments conducive to learning, making, and experiencing music. In 2009, he founded Zambaleta, a nonprofit community world music school based in San Francisco. And in 2011, he created the Nile Project, an initiative to help inspire, educate, and empower university students to work together to foster the sustainability of the Nile ecosystem. Mina, welcome to KALW.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Boy, let's start with Lance. Lance, gosh, you've had such an interesting international career. It seems almost not on the same ballpark for you to do a two-day festival in Berkeley. Tell us about how you had the idea for this festival.
Well, I've seen you have stickers here at KLW about think global and listen local. And so I think there's a little bit of that idea with Uncharted. And, you know, I've dedicated myself to a large extent over the last 5 years to Berkeley Side, which is all about providing local news and information. Uncharted came about because when you think, you know, Rebecca was talking about what's the personality of cities. When you think of Berkeley, I think ideas is something that is organic to Berkeley. And so we thought it's the perfect place to have an annual celebration of that, to bring people together, you know, great thinkers in all sorts of different domains, and to bring the kind of people who love to engage and to really dive into those ideas.
So how do you select the speakers, or do they come after you?
It's an art. It's not a science. You know, taking recommendations from lots of people. You know, I came across Mina, for example. I was at the launch of Cal Performance's 2014-2015 season, and the Nile Project's going to be performing there. And I had a chance to meet Mina, and I think it's just fascinating. So I leaped at the chance to get him. And, you know, other people, it's, you know, finding things that, you know, grab my interest and that I think will grab other people's interest.
Mina, can we talk a little bit now about the Nile Project? It's a fascinating river, of course. It's such an important part of East Africa, part of 11 different countries. Now, what are some of the conflicts that are facing the Nile Basin that caused this very project to get started?
Well, the Nile has a rich history of cultural isolation. So many of the regions sharing the Nile are not considered part of the same entity. You have East Africa around Lake Victoria, you have Ethiopia at the Blue Nile, and you have Sudan, and then you have Egypt that's usually considered North Africa or the Arab world. And as we are, you know, stepping into this era of globalization where we are considering how we can share these finite water resources and with climate change and a lot of environmental pressures, these countries are facing the challenge of realizing that they actually share an ecosystem, and they have to start thinking together about ways they can share these resources and allocate them in a way that is sustainable, not just environmentally, but also politically and culturally. So we're facing a lot of these challenges in the Nile Basin, and I don't think these are unique to the Nile region. We have a lot of these issues here in California as well. So we're really working on addressing this water conflict by starting at the root challenges. How do these people in these 11 countries see themselves vis-a-vis their neighbors? Do they feel like they are part of the same ecosystem of the same Nile community? And how do we inspire this ethic of Nile citizenship when we're starting to talk about these challenges that we face? So that's part of what the Nile Project is doing.
Mm. It's hard to believe that some 400 million people are affected in some way by that river.
It's a long river.
So tell us a little bit about how the cultural barriers that you've faced trying to bring these people together.
Well, the first question that we had when I founded the Nile Project with my co-founder, Meklit Hadero, who's a Bay Area-based Ethiopian-American singer, was whether people in the Nile Basin would respond positively to a project like this. And it was a question more than any assumption. And we had to go there on a scout trip, visited 5 of the 11 countries to ask people whether that's something that would be interesting to them. And what we discovered was really fascinating. A lot of people saw the Nile as a really deep and integral aspect of their cultural identity, but they had very few avenues to express that relationship, to express their membership in this imagined community. So for them, for a lot of the musicians that we spoke with, for a lot of the nonprofit leaders, for a lot of the politicians that we spoke with, the Nile Project was a really interesting new window into a space that fascinates all of us, but have not had the chance to kind of step into. So the Nile Project is really providing that platform that brings these communities together.
Mm-hmm. You have a number of language barriers as well. I mean, 11 different countries are involved in some aspect of the Nile.
I mean, Ethiopia alone has hundreds of languages. Mm. The diversity of the Nile Basin is probably astonishing. I mean, when you think of the cradle of humankind, you think of the Rift Valley, how ancient some of these cultures are, and the amount of different languages and cultural mores and approaches to the Nile. When we just talk about instruments or the mythologies that have gone through these different countries, we start seeing such a vast vocabulary that we can use when we're curating these musical collaborations, when we're addressing these different challenges, whether they are historical, political, economic, environmental. So it's a great problem to work on.
Sure. So it is the Nile that's bringing these people together in a very, very physical sense.
Yep.
So talk to us a little bit about how you're involving music in this project and the importance of the cultural aspect of music in these different entities.
So the story started with an initiative based on our musical curiosity. MacLeet and I, we were both really interested in learning about the musical traditions of each other's countries. The story started when I saw an Ethiopian funk band perform in Oakland after I had just gone back from a summer in Tahrir Square in the revolution in Egypt. And I was still physically in Egypt, but I was in Oakland wondering, how have I never been exposed to this music before? And the project started from that inspiration, from me asking myself, I'm an ethnomusicologist, I'm an applied ethnomusicologist, I work in San Francisco on exposing different people to the musical cultures of other people in the world through Zambaleta, through the World Music School I started. And here I am looking at the problem that I have faced growing up in Egypt, the fact that I had never been exposed to the musical culture of my neighbors. That still exists, the same disjuncture. And what can I do as an ethnomusicologist to increase that exposure and use this musical conversation to address a really important problem that goes way beyond cultural understanding? We're talking about a water conflict that could have been the cause of the first water-based war, as we've saw in the last couple of years.
You're talking about the dam project, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the dam is a manifestation of the conflict. The dam is not the source of the conflict itself. So we saw that the musical conversation that we can curate can really help address this water conflict, because if you want to bring people together to talk about water, you don't start with a geopolitical argument. You don't start with talking about water. So you have to start somewhere else, somewhere that brings people together, builds a level of trust, helps them see what they share. And the musical traditions of the Nile Basin are rich with commonalities. Some of the instruments that we have in Egypt that we saw on ancient Egyptian walls growing up, like the harps and lyres of ancient Egyptians, which we don't see performed today in Egypt anymore, are the main instruments in Uganda or in Ethiopia. So it's really fascinating for an Egyptian audience member to watch these instruments that are stereotypically Egyptian being right. played by a Ugandan and playing Egyptian music today.
It's interesting because, you know, the lyre or the harp is almost in every culture, as you know, as an ethnomusicologist. I'm thinking myself as a flute player, there's the flute in almost every culture as well. But I'm thinking when these people come together, we've got different tonal systems. We've got different ways of looking at music physically versus something printed versus something improvised. So how do people come together in that way?
Well, it's a long process, starting with selection of the musicians and thinking about the different traditions that we'd like to feature. How do we make sense of a collective like this musically so that it sounds coherent? And there is a lot of work that goes into educating these musicians about each other's traditions so that when they're collaborating on composing this new music, they're coming from a place of understanding each other rather than just improvising on top of each other. So we're really trying to use this musical collaboration framework that we are creating as a paradigm shift, as a way to show people in the Nile Basin and elsewhere that there is a different way of organizing ourselves that is based on principles that we learn from nature, like participatory leadership. We don't have to operate based on one party's terms. The collaboration that we're creating can be on everybody's terms, can be the product of everyone's creativity put together. So our collective does not have one musical leader. We don't have one musician that teaches everyone and speaks on behalf of everyone. So you'll see in our performance when we come here in Berkeley and Stanford in February, hopefully, that we have different musicians that take that leadership role of different songs, and then they step back, and the group kind of functions as one of these organisms that are always mutating. How do we develop all of these different skills in the musicians that we have while working on translations and while working on tuning issues? And is the work of our musical director, Miles J, and myself, who have been directing this collective and growing it every year with a number of new musicians.
And let's hear a little bit of music from the Nile Project now, then we'll talk more. What are we going to hear in this excerpt?
So I think we're going to listen to a track from our first album called Us One. That's where it was composed and performed for the first time. And this track is called Tetsita. It's a style of Ethiopian music that was collaborated on by some of our Ethiopian musicians, along with a number of Sudanese, Egyptian, and Ugandan musicians as well.
And then more with Nina Gyrgyz and Lance Noble to talk about Uncharted, the Berkeley Festival of Ideas. Stay with us. Yesterday, it's the time to The Nile Project, music that you can hear next February at Zellerbach Hall in Berkeley. Music and the project of which will be discussed tomorrow and Saturday as part of the Uncharted Berkeley Festival of Ideas. One of the speakers, Mina Girgis, founder of the Nile Project, along with Lance Noble, who is the director and founder of Uncharted. Welcome back to the airwaves, Lance.
Thank you.
So the Nile Project is one aspect of this festival of ideas, and you've got quite a lineup of other things that are happening over this two-day festival. Let's hear about it.
So, you know, having Mina in the studio is, I think, a perfect illustration. It's a combination of, obviously, music, culture, geopolitics, environment, and it's exactly that kind of clash and mix of different domains that we really seek out. And we have speakers in a whole wide range. So there's Randy Shechtman, who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology last year for his work on cells, talking about the future of medical research and where that's going. A brilliant younger biologist, Jennifer Doudna, who's developed this extraordinary new technique for manipulating genes and what are the consequences of that. Ken Goldberg talking about robotics. You know, there's just so much. Carl Bass on 3D printing. You know, it's a whole wide range of different things, and it's that clash of differences. Steve Cole, a Pulitzer Prize winner, dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, on Islamic State. So
John Adams involved as well.
John Adams. However, yesterday John Adams withdrew.
I'm sorry.
You know, he's so shattered by the events of this week. But we're going to kind of turn that into lemonade and actually have a discussion
sure.
about, you know, what are should there be limits to artistic expression, and, you know, what is the nature of censorship, and just how extraordinary it is that this 400-year-old art form, opera, can still excite such passions and can get on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, who would have thought that? So,
we're speaking, of course, of the John Adams opera,
Death of Klinghoffer,
exactly, which faced such controversy in
yeah.
New York.
So, you know, we want to dive into and delve and explore all of these different areas.
And it's when these brains come together, that sensory overload of so many ideas floating around when the new is created.
Absolutely. And it's the clash of domains. You know, in the university, people that work in silos are generally rewarded. And that's the structure is optimized for that single focus. And what we're trying to do, part of what we're trying to do with Uncharted, is to break down those silos and bring musicians together with life scientists, together with roboticists, together with political thinkers. And it's that rich mix of things that I think is very exciting.
Well, let's have you on again for your brain dump after this weekend.
Happy to do that.
Lance Noble, founder and curator of Uncharted, the Berkeley Festival of Ideas. Mina Girgis, thank you for coming on to talk about the Nile Project, a fascinating project which we hope to hear more from as well.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And we'll be you can find out more information about Uncharted, the Berkeley Festival Ideas, at berkeleyideas.com. We're going to hear a little bit more music from the Nile Project as we reset and for the Friction Quartet and their concerts coming up this weekend as well. Stay with us here on Open Air.
Manava mawe
from the Nile Project. Information about this weekend's Berkeley Festival of Ideas Uncharted. 2 days of some thrilling discussion, debate, and dining at berkeleyideas.com. Irregular Resolutions presents Pulling Strings this Saturday at 7:30 at the Center for New Music on Taylor Street here in San Francisco. Irregular Resolutions calls itself a small group of not-so-like-minded composers that has been getting together periodically since 2002, a discussion group first, a support group at times, but most of all a group of composers. Represented on this Saturday's concert will be composers Edward Dierauf, David Graves, Carol Belcher, Harry Bernstein, hi Harry, William Severson, John Belota, as well as a hi to Gary Friedman, friend who's having a couple of his trios performed. Also David Verrota, whose string quartet we'll hear an example of shortly. Bronze Chasm is the title of that work, and we'll hear two movements of that. Davide Verrota also joins us here in studio, as he had this past June as well, to give us some insight into his work, Bronze Chasm. David studied piano at the Milan and San Francisco conservatories and has a parallel track academic life in mathematics as a professor at the University of California in San Francisco. He's actively involved in the new music scene here in the San Francisco Bay Area as not only a composer, but soloist, chamber player, board member, and pianist. He joined me here last June, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back to Open Air and KLW. Hi, David.
Thank you for having me.
David, I've got the same name, but I pronounce it differently. I got to remember, I got to use my left hand up to say David.
Yes, and I have a big accent on the first syllable. David.
David. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, first of all, let's talk about the group of composers known as Irregular Resolutions.
Yes, as we are not afraid of saying, this is an odd collection of people, and we started to get together about 12 years ago, and first it was mostly to eat and drink, which I think you do when you, well, throughout your life, and then we started to basically organize a concert every year, and we basically just organize a concert a year, and this year was our 10th anniversary, and we decided to go with a string quartet. And we are going to have the Friction Quartet playing for us, and also the Telegraph Quartet playing for us. And as you mentioned, there are going to be composition from a number of us. And in addition, we are going to have, just to vary the program a little bit, a piano piece by John Bilotta, and a trio for oboe, English horn, and piano by Gary Friedman.
Let's talk a little bit about your piece that's going to be performed now live in studio called Bronze Chasm.
Right. Well, today I think you're going to hear just the second movement. This is a string quartet that is still unfinished, and Saturday is going to play just the first two movements. It's something that I wrote relatively quickly in August and is highly indebted to the music of Dmitri Shostakovich, which is one of my favorite composers. And it's halfway between an homage to his music and another investigation of what is such a big element of his music in his last year, which is sorrow and pain. He really goes down a very dark alley, starting from the mid-50s, and he barely reemerges from it. And that's part of the title, you know. The way I'm going to develop probably is going to be, you're going to hear today probably one of the most cheerful movements. The second is a dance, basically. But after that, probably it's going to go much deeper and much more bronze chasm kind of way.
All right, this is the Friction Quartet performing music by Davide Verrota, live in studio here at KLW. Thank you. the Friction Quartet, performing a movement from Davide Verrota's work Bronze Chasm. The quartet is Kevin Rogers on violin, Otis Harriel also on violin, Taya Warbelow on viola, and Doug Matches on cello. Fantastic performance. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Wonderful players.
That really, very, very happy to have you guys on. That's just one of the many works that's on this Saturday's 7:30 concert. Davide, tell us just a little bit more about some of the other composers that are represented.
Yes, there are two works that, again, the Friction are going to play, and they're going to be for string quartet and electronics, actually. And so they're going to be particularly interesting, and there's a kind of a mixed media, if you want, and they're by Edward Dieroff and David Graves. One is a homage to Agassi, and it's actually about a very sad situation of old age and Alzheimer's and I guess death creeping in. The second is by David Graves. Again, is a set of small miniatures, and each one is after, I think, a drug or some sort of illicit substance of sorts. Pharmaceuticals, yeah, exactly. And then we're going to have Carol Belcher, and there's going to have a string quartet adapted from some of her original piano music, and he's going to play by the Telegraph Quartet, which is another up-and-coming quartet in the Bay Area. Very excellent players, too. Harry Bernstein, another piece with a... the Telegraph. And finally, William Severson, that is going to have a quintet, actually. He's going to have an additional viola, and is going to be a three-movement piece entitled A Voice from the Past.
Very nice. Well, I wish we had more time to devote to your music. We'll hope to have you on again for your next concert. I should mention that the earlier music that started off today's program was good friend David Conte's string quartet. So thanks for sharing some of that music. Maybe we can have you on to have his full quartet on for open air.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys. Coming up next, Peter Robinson is here to offer us an ode for the month of November, and we'll still have a bit of a ticket giveaway at the very top of the hour. Stay with us here on Open Air. Peter Robinson, a pleasure to welcome you back to KALW, and I understand we've got a movie review as well. Let's see what we got going cooking for here today.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I've been thinking a little bit about that very strange month about to come up, the month of November. And I bring it up because recently I've been hiking down the Tennessee Valley, which is on the edge of the Muir Woods in Marin County. And if you just look at the ground, I first of all think about the autumn leaves falling. And this time of year, in a region of microclimates, November strangely stands out. You know effectively that winter is on the way. There's a crisp offshore breeze coming in from the Pacific. And I think of a closing line from a poem by Thomas Hood. No fruits, no flowers, no leaves, no verbs, no leaves again, November. And that kind of speaks to me. But beyond the question of global warming, beyond the question of a change of seasons in an area that has almost no fall seasons, November has another significance. And I think what it has to do is with memory. We begin, of course, with Halloween. We move into what here is the Day of the Dead, or else in Europe, the famous, not just the Day of the Dead, but the All Souls Day, which in itself repeats the same theme. And for those who may, as my accent suggests, know England, there is also something called Guy Fawkes Day. And this was that crazy day in 1605 when Guy Fawkes, that was his name, set out to blow up the House of Lords as the King, James I, was about to visit. So a good example of early gunpowder terrorism. And there it was, alive and thriving. But November then goes on with more memories, and particularly with the armistice on the 9th hour of the 9th of the 11th day of the 11th month, November, in November 1918, which officially made its way into the American calendar in 1954 with Veterans Day. Again, to do a contrast to Europe, you will see people wearing poppies, little red flowers, as a memory of both the Battle of the Somme and Flanders and all the blood that was spilt there. If we move forward, November also has another significance. There were, in fact, five American presidents born in the month of November: James Polk, Zachary Taylor, Franklin Pierce, Warren Harding, and James Garfield. And Abraham Lincoln himself delivered the Gettysburg Address on November the 19th, 1863. There is, of course, that tragic day, November the 22nd, 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated. So when we look back, we finish the month with Thanksgiving, something installed into the American history by George Washington on November the 26th, 1789. But for me, the word bleak, I think, is the best description. Emily Dickinson concluded, "November always seemed to me the Norway of the year." And yes, I think about bleak, and then comes Black Friday with a shopping spree. But let's pause about that for a moment. Are we still in the recession? Do we still have money to shop? No, perhaps bleak November is our best description.
Thank you, Peter. Very good observation. I always thought that Black Friday meant like traffic madness, and it was a black, dark thing. But it refers to the merchants finally being in the black for the rest of the year because it's such an important day for them.
Well, here, traffic madness in the Bay Area is consistent, so you don't have to distinguish about Friday. Now, talking about bleak, I have been to another war movie. It seems there's always an endless demand for war movies, and this time it is the movie Fury, where our good friend Brad Pitt stars as the sergeant commanding a tank crew. This, to some extent, follows a long tradition. Maybe we go back to the Dirty Dozen, maybe Saving Private Ryan, where we're looking at the breakdown between four people led by the sergeant in a tank and how they get along. And I think for moviegoers, I may stand out differently to some of the other reviewers who see it as a great wartime movie. I see it as a two-part wartime movie. I think the setup at the beginning, how do people struggle under panic and difficult conditions, is certainly the best bit of the movie. How do they live in cramped spaces? And particularly, a good understanding of the Sherman tank, that was the American tank, was certainly less well-equipped than the German equivalent, which was a Tiger II. The chance of dying in a Sherman was far higher, particularly the Sherman IV. So I think there are aspects of this movie which both military historians and movie buffs will definitely enjoy. And the scenes, because it's set in the closing years of the war in April 1945, again, convey that question, is it worth dying for? Would you sacrifice in what was clearly about to be an American victory and an Allies victory? Now, I say the movie divides into two sections because the second section of the film, I hate to say this, reminded me of Shootout at OK Corral. And suddenly you're in that type of environment where you're heavily surrounded, you've got reasonably good firepower, but I will not give a spoiler here, the fight goes on. And to that extent, this is where I've seen variations of this in Westerns, particularly where people are held up in a hut or a shed, and you know something at the end is going to tell the final story. I'll only say here we don't have the cavalry, so I leave for the viewer to discover what is the outcome. So where do I put this? I put this on a movie scale of better than the Dirty Dozen, not as good as Saving Private Ryan, and worth seeing? Yes.
Well, because Brad,
I want you to think about it.
Brad Pitt's in it. I'm going to it to see Brad Pitt. I don't know about you.
Well, Brad Pitt is certainly hitting 50. He does play the sergeant leading the group, and he's mastered the knack of having not a beard, but that sort of stubble that nowadays I think is necessary if you want to be a successful pop star.
Or so baseball player, I think.
You'll catch Brad's bit, but you'll catch a lot of gunfire and the maneuverability of tanks. It does, as you said at the beginning, it reminds me of driving as you go over the Golden Gate Bridge. You have to switch lanes, know where you're going, and make sure there's no blue lights behind you.
Thanks for sharing, Peter. autumn leaves to finish out Peter's ode to the month of October into November. Some tickets to give away these last couple moments of open air. If you're interested in the Peninsula Symphony, they're playing at the Flint Center on Saturday at 8 o'clock, Sunday at Cappuccino High School in San Bruno at 2:30 p.m. John Nakamatsu is the featured soloist for Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. Also on the program, Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition and Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Tickets are available to you. I've got 4 pairs for either performance, Saturday at 8, Sunday at 2:30. If for listeners that call 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. Under the baton of Mitchell Klein and Nathaniel Berman, it's the Peninsula Symphony with guest John Nakamatsu. An hour before each of those performances, yours truly will be offering a pre-concert talk. John's going to join me for a little bit to talk about the Tchaikovsky. I'll also have some interesting things to share with you about pictures at an exhibition. Again, the Peninsula Symphony, 415-841-4134. For tickets either Saturday at 8 o'clock at the Flint Center or Sunday, 2:30, Cappuccino High School in San Bruno. Operators are standing by. Another ticket giveaway, an interesting event that's happening in several theaters here in the Bay Area. It's the Bolshoi Ballet that's going to be performed and projected live in theaters around the Bay Area this Sunday, October 26th at 12:55 in the afternoon. It's a 3-hour approximate running time. It's a special production captured live from the Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow. We've got 5 pairs of tickets for that. That's going to be at the Cupertino 16, 10123 North Wolf Road in Cupertino. If you're interested in seeing that performance, projected performance of the Bolshoi Ballet, 415-841-4134. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. All of our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. You can also browse previous shows. Send me an idea for a segment if you have some cultural event you'd like featured or a group here live in studio. My email address is david@kalw.org. Special thanks today to Niels Swinkels for herding cats, as usual, as my producer of Open Air, and to the Friction Quartet for that live performance. Kevin Vance also did stewardly duty helping with the microphone setup for the quartet. Thanks very much to you, Kevin.